great desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the world's many prolific crime zones. I'm Art Bell, and this program is Coast to Coast AM, covering every single one of them. Great to be here, an honor to be here with you tonight. As it was last night, if you don't get the full Saturday and Sunday program, call your radio station and say, hey, what's up with that? There's nothing more interesting at that time of the night than what they do there. And that's true. The world at this hour, Madrid, Spain, one of the three Moroccans arrested in the Madrid train bombings, was a follower of a suspected Al-Qaeda member jailed in Spain for allegedly helping plan the whole September 11th thing. In fact, in Spain, it did not go well for the sitting party. The socialists there have just scored a dramatic upset in elections, unseating conservatives stung by charges they provoked the Madrid terror bombings by supporting the U.S.-led war effort in Iraq, and therefore making Spain a target for Al-Qaeda, and so they got tossed out on their ear. It works, doesn't it? Terrorism works, doesn't it? If it can do that, if it can get a whole government tossed out on its ear for supporting the U.S. and what we did in Iraq, then it works. Terrorism works. We have got to go. We have got to go kill these people. That's it. They want us dead. They've demonstrated that. They want other people dead around the world that even support us. They need to be real dead, real soon. So we need to get that done. And I almost never say that. Never. But there's just no question. It's flat out, we got to go kill them. And we got to do it fairly quickly. In Moscow, speaking of elections, Vladimir Putin easily wins another term. 69% of the vote. Wow. It's hard to get 69% with that, big a voting base. That's amazing. The Passion of Christ was again the top film. This makes 3 weeks in a row that The Passion has been number one, taking in this time 31.7 million, pushing its total beyond $250 million. Wow! That's a big movie. $250 million in its third week. Whew. And while we're on the subject, I'm going to give you a little tip. If you ever get to be a talk show host or want to be a talk show host, one of the hardest things you will ever do is interview a man who talks to God. as we did last night. It's an incredible thing to do. I mean, on the one hand, you cannot say very much one way or the other because he talks to God. And you don't argue with God's word. Or, even what might be God's word. You have to walk a very fine, really a fine line in such an interview. It's really a remarkable thing. Just absolutely remarkable. So remember that in case you ever get to be a talk show host on the radio. Wait until you've done it a few years before you try interviewing a man who talks to God. Moscow. There is a gigantic fire raging away tonight in a 19th century landmark building just off Red Square. Just minutes after the polls closed in Russia's presidential election. Whoop, up she goes. Two firefighters dead so far. Within an hour after the fire broke out, about half of the 48,000 square foot structure was in flames. Part of the roof had collapsed. News reports said flames shot high into the nighttime sky. Thick gray smoke billowing over the Kremlin towers. Always something going on around. When Ramona and I were at the Kremlin, a shot rang out. In fact, a couple of shots rang out, and we were actually standing in Red Square, and pop, pop, you heard a couple of shots, and later it turned out it was some sort of assassination attempt. Pretty weird to have happen while you're there, huh? Turning for a second, well, I'll tell you what. Let me break here, and we'll come back and do the yet stranger news. Got a word or two I want to say about the DARPA challenge. Hello there. That was enough. Thank you. The DARPA challenge is very interesting. I mean, it was right here in the desert where I am. And, it was an attempt to see if an autonomous vehicle could navigate its way across the desert, you know, with all the switchbacks and turns and hills and stuff like that. And it was a 142-mile course. Now, most of the vehicles pooped out right at the very beginning. There were a couple or a few that made it about as far as 7 miles. This was from Barstow to Prim, Nevada. And a few made it as far as 7 miles, but then they pooped out. That's as far as anybody got in the 142-mile course. And that's not too good. I mean, you know, there were some big companies that had entrants. So what does this say? What does this say? Think about it a little bit. These vehicles didn't get more than 7 miles. So what's the deal here? Does it say how far computers have not come? Or does it say how far the human brain has? I mean, a human behind the wheel would zip right through it. No problem. But the very best they could come up with, and of course, you know, they're saying things like, well, it was a very important first step in a long journey, and of course, that's the kind of thing you say after something like this, I guess. But it means, I guess, computers haven't come that far. And, but once again, you know, there were some big companies with some big brains involved, only 7 miles. So think how important your human brain is! Your brain is an absolute wonder, and computers are nowhere close yet. Not even close. Hey, I think I've got the word here on tomorrow's announcement about some planetary body or some something being found out there, right? From the Australian, Australia's national daily newspaper, it says, it's another world, but is it our 10th planet? Scientists have found a new world orbiting the solar system more than 3 billion kilometers further away from the sun than Pluto and about 40 years away from the Earth in a space shuttle. NASA is expected to announce today the discovery of a space object which some experts believe might be a new planet. It is provisionally known as, and I'm sure I'll slaughter it, Sedna. I would pronounce this S-E-D-N-A, Sedna. After the Inuit goddess of the sea, the discovery of Sedna, or whatever she's properly known as, 10 billion kilometers from Earth, is a testament to the new generation of high-powered telescopes. Sedna's diameter is about 2,000 kilometers, the biggest find in the solar system since Pluto, and of course they don't even want to call Pluto a planet. Pluto doesn't get planetary status. And so I guess Sedna probably won't either. I don't know what they'll end up, maybe a planetoid or some, call it something like that. But that is probably what they're going to announce later today. I don't know. The following article, I'm going to read again tonight because it's way too cool not to. I read it last night, and this is hot stuff, in my opinion. Pravda. Time has been one of the most complicated and less studied scientific issues since ancient times. 8 years ago, American and British scientists who conducted investigations in Antarctica made a sensational discovery, it says. U.S. physicist Marianne McLean told the researchers that something was spinning in a gray fog in the sky over the pole on January 27th, which they believe to be just an ordinary sandstorm. Now, I don't know why you'd have a sandstorm at the pole. Anyway, it goes on. The gray fog did not change form and did not move in the course of time. The researchers decided to investigate the phenomena, and they launched a weather balloon with equipment capable of registering, you know, wind speed, temperature, and air moisture, but the weather balloon soared upwards and immediately disappeared. In a little while, the researchers brought the weather balloon back to the ground with the help of a rope that was attached to it. They were rather surprised, you can imagine, to see a chronometer set in the weather balloon displaying the date January 27th, 1965, the same day 30 years ago. So, they repeated the experiment several times. And guess what? All the equipment was in good repair, and it happened each time the watch was back, displaying the past time. The phenomena was called, quote, the time gate, end quote, and was reported, it says here, to the White House. And they're investigating this phenomena now, they say. So try and imagine that. I mean, really, it's a gray fog of time swirling in Antarctica. And you never know if this kind of thing is true. I mean, it's Pravda, right? So you never know, but it is, you know, their major newspaper, in their biggest newspaper in Russia, and it's a pretty cool story. I don't know, maybe Pravda's going, you know, they're starting to sell it at grocery stores or something. I don't know. And this is interesting, maybe. Calgary, from Canada, our friends to the north. Researchers at the University of Calgary have found, guess what, folks, that nerve cells grown on a microchip can learn and memorize information which can be communicated then to the brain. So what they've done is they've taken actual nerve cells and they're growing them on computer chips. That's biological stuff, like us, growing on computer chips. And then they say that will allow a computer chip then to directly talk to the human brain. It goes on, quote, we discovered that when we use the chip to stimulate their neurons, their synaptic strength was enhanced. This is a neurobiologist at the University of Calgary's Faculty of Medicine. The nerve cells also exhibited, get this, memory traces that were successfully then read by the chip, said Syed, co-author of the landmark study published in February's edition of Physical Review Letters, that's certainly a well-respected international journal. So what they're doing here is they're beginning to grow biological cells on chips, which means that ultimately the chips would be able to communicate directly with the human brain. Now, that would be some interface, wouldn't it? Can you imagine that? Your computer boots up and talks directly to your brain. You know that's coming. You gotta know it's coming. And pretty fast, I guess, too. But it's never gonna be able to go more than 7 miles over rocky terrain. Orion, here we go. This is Moscow again. This time, though, Associated Press. Orion, the Big Dipper, and Andromeda could be joined in the heavens by, are you ready? Ads for soft drinks and cigarettes. If a Russian inventor's device catches on, Alexander Leronov, a spacecraft designer, said he has now patented a device for putting advertisements into space that would be seen from Earth. This is from Interfax News Agency. Space commercials could embrace huge areas and a colossal number of consumers, said he. This would literally be intercontinental coverage. So flashing across your night sky could be, and this has been thought of before, Coca-Cola or, you know, chicken wings. I don't know what would be up in space, but I know that we should not allow it. Man should not allow that to occur. It seems like space ought to be sacrosanct from commercial advertisements. Unless it was for Coast to Coast AM. And then there's finally this story. And it's a horrible, horrible story in Canada. and it's always hard to know how to present this, but you've probably heard about this. There's this meat farm up in Canada. And, let's see, the Port Coquitlam farm, I guess. Investigators have found DNA at the farm site that's been matched to several women missing from Vancouver's downtown east side. There's a farmer facing 15 counts of first-degree murder. And they are saying they cannot rule out the possibility that cross-contamination may have occurred. In other words, between the possible 15 counts of first-degree murder of women and the meat that was packed up there. You get the idea, right? God, this is a horrible story. Horrible. Anyway, the story ends up at the end. You know, this is being covered big time here in the West. And here's the way the story ends up. Anyone who still has frozen meat from the farm is asked to contact the Missing Woman Task Force. You know, I was ready to say only in modern America, but this is Canada. So, this meat was not distributed apparently to, you know, like grocery stores and things like that, but it was sold apparently locally up there. And let's see, Kendall said the meat was never distributed commercially. There you go. But about 40 friends and neighbors ate meat from the farm during barbecues or were given some to take home. We live in a crazy world. The world, to some degree, in my opinion, is going nuts. The world is going crazy. We almost began this as a topic of conversation after I was on ham radio last night after this. You know, these kind of topics we talk about. And this was one of them. It's probably a good one. The world is going crazy, in my opinion. Bonkers. Politically, I mean, look where we are today with terrorism. We have people trying to kill us and anybody else who even likes us, like Spain. I mean, we're killing each other at a faster clip than ever before. The hatreds are as deep or deeper than they've ever been in all of our lives, even considering what's gone on in the Middle East. Socially, we're not exactly marching ahead. If you consider the state of the world right now, it's crazy. Socially, we're beginning to see more of this kind of thing happen, you know, mass murders. People who eat other people, people who grind people up and sell them to neighbors for barbecues, and oh my God. Of course, the only consoling part of this is not at least a regular story. You know, it's fairly irregular, and the fact that we're calling attention to it like this means that it thankfully doesn't happen that frequently. But it seems like in recent years, 10, 20 years, last 10, 20 years, there's been a lot more of it than ever before. Shall we dance? East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay, sir. Where are you?
Middletown, Connecticut.
Oh, really? All right. I know where you are. And your first name?
Peter.
Peter. Okay, Peter, what's up?
I'm listening to you on WTIC out of Hartford.
Right.
I was listening the other night to George's show, and I don't remember the guest's name he had on about the theory of the New World Order.
Yes.
And he was saying that something to do with George Bush and the Skull and Crossbone Society and and the Minions and whatnot. And well, I believe that, like, the incident in Spain is an example of that. And that what's going to end up happening in the next several years from now is that the United Nations will be taking over our country as far as policing it.
I think that'll be over our dead bodies collectively, sir. I don't agree with you, and I don't think that certainly there is a Skull and Crossbones, but do I think it's in charge of some newer world order that either okays or is part of killing its own citizens? No, sir, I don't believe that. I definitely, whatever argument I may have with the president, I don't, not a million years. And this kind of accusation has been made about almost every president. And I don't for one second believe that. I believe when most decent men attain that high office, they do rise to it, and they don't order the death of their own citizens. So I'm sorry, that one's way too far out there for me. From the high desert in the middle of the night, this is the one and only Coast to Coast AM.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
This is a group called Matisse, and I know it's driving a lot of people crazy. It's one of those earworm songs, and I get it, and I love it. It's from, it was used in Dead Like Me on Showtime. If you haven't caught that yet, I bet a lot of you have by now, much as I talked about it. You've got to check it out. Dead Like Me is a very cool program. It'll be coming back in the summer on Showtime, and I would love to have George grab my soul in a situation. I don't even like TV, so that tells you what I think of it. So, hey, George, my soul is up for grabs. We'll continue with open lines in a moment. By the way, coming up in the next hour is Nick Cook from Jane's Defense Weekly, and we'll talk about zero-point energy. By the way, we just watched on DVD Matchstick Men. Now, that was a cool movie. I mean, that movie, without giving you any hint at all of what I'm talking about, takes you at the end and twists you like a pretzel with no mercy whatsoever. That ending, it takes you and just grabs you and turns you all the way around mentally. It takes your brain and smashes it on the table. It's that kind of movie. Anyway, back to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Dan. KFI 640 AM, Riverside.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
Thank you. Another great show last night. I tried to get through. I was going to ask Benjamin if who the concentration camps were.
Oh, I could tell you what his answer would probably be.
Yeah.
Shall I?
Sure.
It'd be for the Christians.
That's what I suspected.
Yeah. That's what he'd probably say. I'm telling you, man, if you want to do the hardest interview that a talk show host can do, I guarantee you.
You did a great job.
Just try and interview someone who talks to God. That, baby, is a challenge.
Yeah, you did a good job. But, you know, I've had similar experiences. Like him, there's years and years of drought.
I understand. I mean, we are basically a Christian nation, and man, you've got to walk the road you have to walk when you do an interview like that. It's really something. It's really something. Anyway, go ahead.
The only thing I can add is to identify that voice as not being your own subconscious or some sort of demonic spirit, as opposed to. He mentioned several times the sheep know the shepherd's voice, so to speak.
Well, he basically said, you know it when you hear it.
Yeah, and I've heard it.
You can't argue with that. I mean, you can't argue with any of it.
I heard it and it saved my life twice.
That you can't argue with either. See, that's exactly what I mean. There you are. It saved your life. And, you know, I don't know what it said. Hit stop sign. Don't cross that road. Don't take that flight. Whatever. And if that's happened to you, then you're a believer, and that's all there is to that. That never happened to me. Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Art, oh, great one.
How you doing?
I'm good. This is Matt. I'm in Tampa, listening to you on 970 WFLA.
Yes, sir.
I've talked to you a couple times before. I was the guy that had the haunted taxi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm in another line of work. But, the guy that was talking last night, there's a common misconception. I was just trying to find it in my Bible, and I couldn't look it up right now. But God is not currently in control of the world.
Okay.
He has ceded that to the adversary to let him have his fun and do whatever he wants to.
So God made us and said, okay, devil, here, these are your toys.
No.
Well, it sounds that way.
No, he gave Adam the choice. You can follow me and live in paradise.
From the apple on, we were dead meat.
Yeah, and that's why Jesus was sent for redemption.
All right, well, I appreciate it. Thank you. I don't know. These are hard things to think about. And, you know, some people believe that God is in control of every little detail. Others do not. If he is, that brings hard questions. If he isn't, that still brings hard questions. The whole thing is hard. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Art. Sean from Washington, D.C. It's 603 WMAL. How you doing?
I am doing ever so well, Sean. Welcome.
Thank you. This isn't exactly why I'm calling, but I wanted to note my father works at FEMA, and they can barely figure out how to get snow off the roads.
Yeah. Well, so, I would like to thank FEMA officially.
Yeah.
They have filed against something called BPL, Broadband Over the Power Lines, which is going to screw up the ham radio frequencies.
Oh, really?
And FEMA made a nice filing with the commission against it, so bless them.
Oh, well, good.
Yes.
Good. Yeah,
anyway,
I mean,
what were you calling about originally?
I'm calling. Well, you said something last night that really made me think, which is exactly why I listened to Coast to Coast.
Yeah. Right.
You said that, say that there was some impending global disaster.
Yes.
That mass consciousness might be able to...
Might be the only thing.
Might be perhaps the only thing powerful enough to deflect it.
Yes.
And I thought about that, because for whatever reason I've been thinking about what's called Fermi's paradox a lot, which is, where are all the aliens?
Mm-hmm. Or, yes.
If you sort of think, gee... see the UFOs, there they are, why are they being so secretive about it?
Hmm.
Well, if you think, if mass consciousness possibly has this power, maybe that's why the aliens aren't showing up, because nothing would focus the attention of the world.
Could be we're even manifesting the aliens.
That's another possibility that I've thought about a lot, a sort of Jungian archetype. They do look an awful lot like us.
It's like from Planet X, the monster of the id, you know, all comes from inside.
Yeah, but if like they're hiding from us, if they do exist and they're not showing up, or at least sort of sparsely showing up, maybe that is because of the potential power of mass consciousness to do them some harm.
Maybe, or here's another one. I mean, think about the Prime Directive. The Prime Directive would almost be like the Golden Rule. Let's say that we were able to travel in space, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that we came upon a planet where, let's say they were just past the Stone Age and beginning to emerge. Would it? Do you think it would be the collective vote of Earth to go in there and, you know, bring them up to date and sell them burgers and whatever all we do and change their culture totally? Or do you think that it would be hands-off and let them develop the way they're going to develop?
Well, you know, our history isn't so great. I mean, we've taken people out of, we've taken Kalahari Bushmen and taught them how to drive, you know, bulldozers. So,
well, yeah, we've done that.
I mean, if you take that sort of, the thing is that if it's a zoo hypothesis, if it's like the Prime Directive, then that would have to apply to everybody.
But here's the question. Wouldn't a sufficiently advanced race, socially and intellectually, probably adhere to that rule? I think they would. And that could account for the lack of contact. What do I know? West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was just going to comment on Benjamin Baruch.
Oh, man. You know, I knew it. I mean, at the time, you should have seen the emails that I was getting. But there's going to be more impact from that show one way or the other. Go ahead and comment.
Yeah, I got it to ring, but I never did get through. You know, I wanted to hear what he did say, you know, what God said when he said, I want to talk to this people, or he was in that meeting. Unfortunately, they got skipped over, but...
Yeah, that was the group of investors, right?
Right, the second group. But
yeah.
I thought it was, you know, he really sounded for real and everything, but there was one thing that kind of caught me. I mean, a couple things, but one thing was, you know, obviously he was probably a Hebrew, Jewish guy, and now he's, you know, believes in Jesus, and that's great. I kind of do myself, but he did, you know, he said when he found out what was going to happen in the United States, he broke down and fell on his
yep.
face in the living room and
yep.
went into tears and everything else.
Yep.
But then later in the show, he was talking to you and laughing about, you know, getting on the air and doing a blow-by-blow as the waves come by through the United States as if, you know, it would be like a football game, and he was
yeah.
all jovial about it.
Yeah, I remember the football game analogy.
It was kind of like a major contradiction to me.
Yeah, well, it was, I'll tell you something, sir, honestly, it was one of the stranger interviews I've ever had to do on radio in all my years of doing them.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I'm still suffering eating pizza without the super sauce. And hey, maybe you can get someone to do a thing on chemtrails, huh?
Maybe. I'll consider that. I haven't made up my own mind about chemtrails yet. I've seen them. They don't look like contrails. They're oily, they spread to the entire sky. Are they doing something? I think so. Weather modification? Maybe. Inoculation? Maybe. Maybe a figment of our imagination. I don't know. International Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. It's Paul calling from Vancouver, B.C.
Well, hello, Paul.
How are you to this evening?
Quite well, thank you.
I won't talk about the pig farm, but I got a couple other things I'd like to ask you about.
Is that making big news up there?
Well, it has been. I mean, it's, you know, something that's been going on for the last 3 years, but this guy is just a real creep that's done this. And,
yeah,
I don't really want to talk about it. What I wanted to ask you is about this impending asteroid that's supposed to be coming September 29th. Have you heard anything more about that?
No, I don't know a hell of a lot about it. Wayne Green was on here with somebody else talking to George about it, and I'm sorry, I don't know. I know that the forecast is made. I don't know where it is, what the deal is now.
Yeah, because my birthday is September 27th, and I sure don't want to have that happening. My second question is, I saw that trailer on that movie, The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes.
That looks exciting.
Doesn't it?
Oh, my goodness.
And if that doesn't, you know, at the end with New York and the snow and the ice, save as many as you can. If that doesn't stand your hair up, nothing will.
Oh, absolutely. And another thing, I saw a picture of your cat. He is so cute. I've got a Maine Coon myself.
Yeah, oh, you do?
Yes, I do. And I believe they're part of the raccoon family, because you know what, the coon?
Yeah.
Because my cat used to be outside, and there was a whole family of cats that came by. I mean, a whole family of raccoons. And normally they'd fight, but they just, my cat just stood up to him and they just respected it and just went away. It was really strange.
All right. Well, look, cats are not supposed to have, they're not supposed to have vanity, are they?
I don't know.
Should not be in a cat's litany of things that it ever thinks about would be vanity. But I'm telling you, sir, my cat, Yeti,
yep,
he looks at himself in the mirror. And you can see him doing it. You can see him posing. You can see him saying to himself, well, hey, I don't look half bad. I'm telling you, this cat has vanity, serious vanity.
Yeah. My goodness. They're wonderful creatures, though.
They're incredible. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Right. Take care. Yeah. There's absolutely no question about it. I know you probably don't believe me, but this cat, he knows he looks good. He poses. He examines himself in the mirror and looks around, takes a different view of this way and that way, and looks at himself intently with an admiring little gleam in his eyes. Maybe that's all the things I'm attaching mentally, but I'm telling you, no, that's not true. I know what I'm seeing. And this cat has vanity. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello. Turn your radio off, please.
I just did.
Thank you. Where are you?
I'm in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Listening on the Streamlink.
Yes, sir. Oh, the free this weekend Streamlink.
Well, actually, I've had you for a couple of years now.
Yeah, I know. It's a free weekend. But plus, you can now burn it like on a CD.
I tried that a little while ago. I'm going to have to learn a little more about my computer.
But it's a great thing for them to offer, sir. Great.
Well, I've got the CD burner and all that stuff. I just haven't figured out how to do the.
You will learn. All you do is you make the MPEG-3 the way you want, I guess. I haven't tried it yet either from the site, but you get essentially end up with an MPEG-3 and you just burn it right to a CD. You'll learn. It's easy.
I've got Windows Media, and it's supposed to have a compression package in it. But anyways, the reason I called, that guy you had last night?
Oh, yes.
Did it seem to you that he was a whole lot more comfortable when he was talking about the finance and all the rest of this stuff than when he was actually talking about his conversations with God?
Yeah, but I would expect that. I mean, one is not exactly the same as the other. I was impressed with several things last night, as well as troubled. I was impressed, number one, that he knew what the hell he was talking about when it comes to finance. And number two, I also think he absolutely believes that he talked with God. And beyond that, I don't know. It was the opportunity of a lifetime, because that's one of the hardest interviews you'll ever do as a talk show host, is interviewing someone who talks to God. I guarantee you.
Okay, let me throw one more quick one, and then I'll get out of your way.
Yeah.
Dolores Cannon, you had her on years ago. What was the... Did you just move completely away from that, or what?
Well, from what?
You've had... What's his name on? The other guy with the Nostradamus thing?
I've had hundreds.
Oh, I know.
Thousands.
I've been listening to you for a long time. I used to listen to you driving around South Dakota.
So what do you mean? Did I move away from what?
You haven't had her on in several years.
And oh, that's true.
Where I've found her books extremely intriguing.
Oh, I'd be willing to have her back. All right?
All right. Thanks, Art.
Yep, we'll take a look at it. Thanks. Yeah, I suppose thousands of interviews, actually. And so I'm telling you, in those thousands, the one last night was in its own way one of the hardest things, hardest interviews I've ever done, from the point of view of, well, I'm not even going to go into it. You can just imagine, if you didn't hear it, and if you did, you can go back and review it and say to yourself, what would I have said there? Now, I suppose you can go outside the limits and you can say, well, I would have said, man, what a huckster you are, aren't you? You know, no, of course you wouldn't say that. You might say that, but you might get in trouble. And on the other hand, I didn't necessarily believe he was a hoaxer. I think he probably believes it, and maybe, you know, you also have to allow for the possibility it really happened. He really did talk to God. Yeah, he's got kind of an overblown personality, and he certainly believes in himself like my Yeti. But maybe God does. Who knows how God picks somebody to talk to. So it's a, I hear my wife laughing in the other room. So it's one of those things you listen to and you do, and it's pretty interesting. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
How you doing, Art?
I'm doing all right, sir.
Little situation happened to me the other day.
Yeah.
I drive a truck.
Yes.
I called my house on my cell phone.
Right.
Left a message on the answering machine for my son to call me.
Right.
I get home the next day. Me and my son are sitting there talking. The phone rings. It is me on the phone leaving the message.
Ooh, that's pretty weird.
Yeah.
That's really weird. Now, in fact, you have an answering machine, right? So
yes.
When you originally called, the answering machine did pick up.
It picked and up,
you
and
did,
I left the message.
And you left the message, and then you got home, and the same call came through again. Was the original message there first?
No.
My
son are sitting there looking at each other, and I said, that's me.
You weren't dragging that 18-wheeler across some sort of fog in Antarctica, were you?
I don't think so.
Well, I'm not sure what to say to that.
I mean, it was strange. Now, just today, I'm sitting at the computer. I have my cell phone there, and I have caller ID on my cell phone.
Yeah.
And it rings, and it says home. I'm the only one in the house, and I'm on the computer.
Huh. Well, what's to say to that?
Yeah.
You're like the man who talks to God.
I don't think so.
I was asking,
oh, God.
Well, see, there you are. So are you out at 18-wheeler right now?
Yeah.
You are. All right.
Driving across Ohio.
Ohio. All right. Yep. Well, listen, the hour's blown. We got to go, but thanks for the call.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care. Yes. The world is definitely going crazy. It's full of all kinds of different folk. Different people with different ways, and they're getting weirder and weirder and weirder by the year.
Sweet dreams are made of the ends. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by.
Can some people really...
Talk with Art Bell. Call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Running in the night, with the night, playing in the shadows. That's what we do here. Coming up in a moment, Nick Cook Listen to this now. He's an award-winning defense and aerospace journalist who, for the past 15 years, has been aviation editor at Sirius and aerospace consultant of the world-renowned trade publication Jane's Defense Weekly. That's heavy-duty stuff. Nick is a regular contributor to the Financial Times, has written for numerous newspapers in the United Kingdom, which, by the way, is where he is for this interview, all the way to England. His analysis was sought by UK, US, and other world news media during the 91 Gulf War and the 99 Kosovo conflict. In his 18-year career, he has visited the world's leading defense establishments, has gained access to numerous top-secret military facilities and bases in the U.S. and former Soviet Union. In addition, his two-hour documentary for the Discovery Channel, Billion Dollar Secret, detailed for the first time the secret inner workings of America's classified weapons establishment. In a moment, Nick Cook. By the way, Nick Cook's book is The Hunt for Zero Point. We better find it pretty soon or we're going to be in deep stuff. You know, it says in here, Nick, and welcome to the program, by the way, from Great Britain.
Thanks, Art. Good morning. How are you?
Very well. And you're in London, huh?
I am indeed.
London. Well, you know, just for fun at the beginning here, Nick, it says that you've been in some of the most secret places, defense places, you know, here in the U.S. and in Russia. And I was sitting here thinking, Jane's Defense Weekly, of course, has an impeccable, wonderful reputation. And if I were like an Army general or Air Force general or something, you would be the last guy in the world that I'd ever let near any of my secret stuff.
Yeah, well, I guess there is an argument for saying that. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, any reporter will tell you that everyone has an agenda. And, you know, even some Russian in a general in a base in the deep, dark wastes of Siberia somewhere probably has a message he wants to get out. And, you know, I've been very lucky in working for Jane's for 15-odd years. And I found that because of its impeccable reputation its credentials, that I was able to get in there, into some of these places, at a time perhaps when others might not. And of course, doing what I do, as an aerospace and defense reporter, that was fascinating for me. It was an opportunity I wasn't going to pass up, and I was extremely fortunate to be reporting on that world, particularly round about the kind of the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, a dozen odd years ago. And it was just fascinating to be in those places, talk to those people, and kind of come out with the story.
Yeah. Hey, Nick, I've got a straight-on question for you.
Sure.
In your opinion, are there weapons in space?
That is a very difficult one. I personally don't subscribe to some of these views that I see and read that space is littered with space weapons developed in secret under the Star Wars program. There may have been, I think, the odd experimental deployment of weapons in space. Of course, even that is not admitted to, but I think that's as far as it extends. I do not subscribe to the view that space is seething with an American shield of space weapons. Either.
No, I didn't say that.
No, I know you didn't, but I have read it in kind of some of the more extreme literature that is or maybe what's happening.
And well,
I don't see any evidence for that.
Okay, well, if you think like our top defense chiefs would have to think, then one of the things that you would have to think would be, if we have a war, the first thing that we want to knock out is the enemy's satellites. They've got to go boom like that. They've got to be the first thing that goes, take communications away from them, and so I guess for one second I don't believe that we don't have the capability to blast a satellite the hell out of space if we want to.
Oh, I have no doubt that that capability exists. You're absolutely right. Given that, as you say, modern warfare relies, if not wholly, then almost wholly on the ability to rely on information derived from space. And America knows that. America's rivals know that.
Yep.
And if you want to disable that capability, the capability of your enemy, you're absolutely right. What you have to do is deploy space weapons. And I've no doubt that that capability is ready for deployment, but that doesn't mean that it's up there waiting in space.
But how could you not test it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that that kind of capability has probably been tested.
Oh, I see.
But you have, and you know, America is very adept, as some other countries are, but the States is particularly adept at deploying or putting into practice a principle called deployable prototypes. That is to say, you test prototypes in secret, and you have them at a point where they are ready to be deployed. Now, that is quite a long way from having a mass production of these things already and waiting to head out into whatever domain they work on. But deployable prototypes, such as an anti-satellite weapon, I have no doubt exist out there ready for deployment.
Well, wouldn't some sort of beam energy weapon be probably the most reasonable thing to use in space for that purpose? I mean, just literally fire a hole right through some.
Well, you know, anti-satellite weapons have been around for a while. In fact, you know, almost 20 years ago, the States deployed what it called was an ASAT, an anti-satellite weapon launched from a fighter aircraft, actually, which was a missile that could head off into space, attack a particular satellite. But you're right, beam weapons are also out there. I mean, the most identifiable beam weapon is the laser. The Soviets tested very high-power lasers during the 1980s, and we can only presume that that capability still exists. The States, too, has a very adept laser capability. You don't have to deploy that laser in space. You can build, for example, a dazzling laser weapon which would blind the optics of a satellite.
Well, I'm not all that great with physics, Nick, but it seems to me that a laser, with its limitations in going through the atmosphere and losing power because of the atmosphere, would be really let loose and awfully efficient and awfully effective in space.
Well, it would be, but still we have the capability, even now, to overcome. I mean, you're right. Getting a beam to propagate correctly through a dense atmosphere is a very challenging requirement. But with modern computing and modern optics, that can be done. You don't have to deploy your laser weapon or your laser dazzling capability in space. You could do that from the Earth. The Russians did. The States has that capability too. Of course, it's more effective if you do it in space, but it doesn't have to be there.
All right. We're really here tonight to talk about zero point. Well, you know, we'll probably talk about a lot of things, but I do want to talk about if the world doesn't come up with something pretty soon to replace fossil fuels, then either we're going to run out of them or we're going to so damage our planet ecologically that it won't matter. So a new energy source is really important. And everybody's heard a lot about this zero-point energy, so-called. Nobody's really exactly seen it yet, as far as I know. What do you know about it so far?
Well, it's an evolving story, of course. I mean, I got into it when I was researching a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, which came out a couple of years ago. And it came to it from a rather...
I missed a little. I'm sorry. The phone did something. We missed a second. Start again.
Well, I came at the whole zero-point energy story from a rather tangential direction. I was actually investigating anti-gravity as a possibility. And 10 years ago, I had absolutely no idea whether anti-gravity was possible or not. But I kind of felt and had been given some tips that it may be a story worth looking into. Of course, it was a very, for a magazine like Jane's, it was a very esoteric subject material.
Indeed.
So this is kind of something that I was looking into on my own beat.
Well, maybe I ought to stop you long enough to say, what did you discover, please, about anti-gravity? And then we'll go on to zero point. Is there really anti-gravity per se? And if there is, please describe it.
Well, I published my findings of that 10-year search in a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, which, to my mind, proved beyond doubt that anti-gravity is possible.
Prove it to me.
There were numerous experiments. There have been numerous experiments done, but perhaps one of the more peer-reviewed experimentations was something was an experiment done by a Russian called Evgeny Podkletnov, who was experimenting with superconductors. Those are materials that do not lose their electrical that have no electrical resistance, effectively. Now, he wasn't looking for an anti-gravitational effect when he was doing his experiment kind of 10 years ago, but he found that when he dangled a weight above a superconductor, that it lost around 3% of its weight.
That's right.
Now, that should be impossible under physics, but Podkletnov was finding that. And later on, backed by an Italian physicist called Giovanni Modenesi, Modenesi came up with theory which underpinned Podkletnov's experiments.
But hasn't there been quite a bit of a controversy, Nick, in perhaps not always being able to repeat his experiment? I think it was tried in quite a number of different locations with varying degrees of success.
Absolutely. Now, NASA tried to replicate that experiment and could not.
Right.
Now, having said that, NASA funding was cut before it could complete its experimentations. But what interests me, and I pick up on what the science and technology community is saying, is that there is a lot of great faith amongst scientists and technologists that there is real science underpinning this heretical physics, because at the moment it is heretical physics. It's new physics which don't have any adherence from the old physics community. The old physics community, steeped in the ways of Newton and Einstein, which is as it should be, are very skeptical that what we're seeing here is real. But I follow the community as a whole, and there is a lot of debate within the space, aerospace, defense communities, which shows me that they believe that there is real, or there may be real science in what is happening here. And I follow that. You know, I would be foolish as a reporter not to comment on that debate. And to my mind, at the end of the Hunt for Zero Point, I was satisfied that there was something real happening in the anti-gravitational field.
I don't think
it's readily repeatable.
Have you taken any heat from your colleagues for even writing about this?
Well, yeah, of course. When I wrote this 2 years ago, it was really out there. I mean, none of my colleagues were writing and reporting on this stuff.
Right.
Now I note, for example, 2 weeks ago in Aviation Week and Space Technology, which is America's foremost aerospace technical publication, that they are now writing about zero-point energy. They had an article 2 weeks ago talking about how zero-point energy may be mined as an energy source to take us out into deep space, out to the stars in maybe 50, 100 years' time. So I'm really pleased about that, because it shows that my peers are also beginning to report on this real science. And that's what it is. It's just science we haven't properly quantified yet. But
when we unfold this zero-point thing a little further, do you think, just asking for an opinion here, that we're going to run smack into what Nikola Tesla was doing so long ago?
Yeah, I think there's very good evidence to show that what Tesla was doing 100-odd years ago will be verified by the physics of the zero-point energy field. Mm. I've absolutely no doubt about that.
Hmm.
And it's curious that we are now, 100 years later, beginning to catch up on some of those early pioneers. It was as if, for 100 years, that science was completely forgotten.
Yes.
But that happens sometimes in history, and
that's,
I think it'll be proved. It will be, you know, Tesla will be proven out.
Well, as you know, my government here in the U.S. Went in and seized all of Tesla's writings and lab work and took everything when he died. And one, I think, ought to presume that they tried to make, you know, progress from Tesla's materials. And do you, as a reporter, have any idea whether there was an official follow-up with Mr. Tesla's stuff and how far they got?
Well, I never really followed the Tesla story up in any great depth, but I am aware of the FBI moving in on his apartment when he died.
Yes.
I am aware that they classified a lot of his material.
Yes.
And it seems to me, I mean, when you look at perhaps similar instances of the government moving in to secure knowledge that it doesn't want let out today,
mm-hmm.
We see, as you know, the governments everywhere in the Western world clamping down on proliferating technology they don't want to get into the wrong hands. I find it quite likely that 50-odd years ago, when Tesla died, in fact, he died during the Second World War, a time of particular security concerns, that the government would have stepped in then and gone, we don't want this knowledge getting out. We don't necessarily understand this knowledge, but we do think that what this man Tesla was doing was interesting and perhaps dangerous. And those ideas in the wrong hands could be fatal to us.
Maybe one of these days, Nick, you will decide to go digging for the Tesla story. And you would think after all this time that it might be possible to, I don't know, file some kind of freedom of information thing or get to the right person and really find out what happened with Tesla.
Well, the truth is a very interesting thing, isn't it? And I'm sure on your program, Art, that you have explored the very fine line that exists between myth and reality all of the time.
Yes.
And what I have learned from investigating this story and others is that, you know, even when you have so-called proof from government archives about things that have happened or not happened, your senses, when faced with the incredible, are still telling you, come on, I'm still not sure, even though I'm looking at a government file here, whether this story is true or not. I mean, that takes you perhaps into the UFO question. I've seen countless documents supposedly from very senior government officials saying, particularly when the phenomenon first arose in the modern era in the late 1940s, Air Force generals going in classified memorandums, what is this phenomenon? But still, the official position in government circles is that the UFO phenomenon is not real, it does not exist, and we've got nothing to say on it. And yet, their files were full of Air Force generals saying, what the hell's happening out there? So there is a very fine line between reality and myth, and this zero-point story, to a degree, travels on that very fine line. But to my mind, it's more in the domain of reality than myth, and that's why I choose to pursue it.
Well, I don't think there is any more important subject you could be pursuing. I mean, as I said at the beginning, and I don't know if you agree with such a dramatic statement, but I think either we're going to run out of oil and fight wars over it as we run out, or we're going to end up polluting ourselves to the point that it'll be a moot matter. And that's how important it is that we find some new source of energy. Do you think it's not quite that dramatic?
Well, there are, of course, all kinds of predictions, scientific predictions, on how much energy we have left in terms of oil, natural gas, and coal.
Okay, well, hold that thought. We'll come right back to this when we get back. We're at the bottom of the hour. Nick Cook is my guest from Jane's Defense Weekly. This is a very, very well-respected journal in the UK, actually worldwide. And we've got him for the remainder of the program tonight. It's going to be a very interesting program. So, as the old saying goes, try not to touch that dial. This is Coast to Coast AM in the nighttime.
See the real heart. Tension jumping all around the world.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Hey, you know, that's the way it happens in science. They're looking for one thing, and then, boom, the happening, if something else entirely happens, and they've just made a discovery. My guest is Nick Cook, who's been the aviation editor and aerospace consultant of the world-renowned trade publication, James Defense Weekly. That long in that job, and this man certainly knows what he's talking about. We'll get right back to him. Incidentally, for what it's worth, I'm an avid reader, and there's a really good book I'm reading right now about a weapon in space, a really bad weapon in space. The author is Tom Grace, and it's a book out on the stands right now called Bird of Prey. Bird of Prey. And if you're a person who likes science fiction based on probable science fact, then you're going to love this thing. So if you see it on the bookshelves, Bird of Prey, I'm reading that now. It's really good, about a weapon in space. Back to Nick Cook. Nick, where in the world of, would you put our need for 0 point, or, you know, something to replace what we've got now? How critically, dramatically important is it?
Well, of course, I mean, there are various predictions about how much fossil fuel energy we have left. I've read estimates that, you know, we're going to start running out of oil in 50 years, but maybe that might extend out to 250 years. I think the essential point is that we are now becoming much more aware of the need to dispense with the fossil fuel economy, certainly from an environmental standpoint. And what is interesting is that, to my mind, there have been various people who stepped forward saying that they have developed zero-point energy devices. I've been speaking to a number of them over the past few years, and I am satisfied that there are people who are extracting energy from the vacuum. Now, the levels of energy at the moment that people are getting out using these pieces of technology are small to negligible, but the fact is they are managing to extract energy from the zero-point field, and in time, I have no doubt that increasingly usable amounts of energy will be extracted by these pieces of technology and put to use. I mean, one can imagine. We haven't really spoken about what zero-point energy is yet, and perhaps we ought to do that.
And it's related to gravity, and we will in 1 second. There's one other thing I want to ask you about. There was a scientist, I read the story last night, in Great Britain, there's a big row about it and big headlines. He was speaking up about this past summer in France and, you know, the trouble they had with the weather in Europe. And he was making a statement, perhaps critical of the Bush administration, perhaps critical of the world, and talking about environmental disaster at a level that exceeds the danger presented currently by terrorism, this environmental disaster that he thinks was man's hand, and I guess the government at Downing told him to shut his mouth.
Yeah, this was an interesting story. It surfaced a few weeks ago. In essence, the British government's chief scientific advisor had stepped up and said exactly that,
yeah,
that in his view, the threat from fossil fuels to the environment was at least as bad, if not exceeded, the threat of global terrorism. Now, of course, that was a message that the government here did not want to see reflected, particularly by one who was aligned to the government in such a way. I mean, you know, the chief scientific advisor is the guy who gives the government and the prime minister serious scientific advice.
Yes.
And for him to be saying this was, you know, something that undermined the strength of the British-American special relationship.
Yes.
So, he was effectively gagged.
The Spanish-American relationship just seemed to have an effect today in Spain, didn't it? The Spanish government got tossed out on its ear in favor of labor. And, you know, the AP story that I'm reading on it suggests that the reason may be for, Spain's support of America in the effort in Iraq.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, as a defense journalist at Jane's, I've covered the UK-US special relationship in some depth. And I find it actually a very interesting subject because what it tells me is that whatever happens on the surface politically is just political froth. The real essence of these relationships between the U.S. and other countries, and I can particularly speak for the U.S.-UK special relationship, is the relationship that happens at a much deeper level. You know, the level of exchange that takes place between the military intelligence and intelligence communities of the U.S. and the U.K. has been going on at this intensity since the Second World War. And whatever happens on the surface politically, it does not affect what happens, the exchange of information between officials at that deep U.S. That deep military and intelligence level.
Mm.
And that is what binds two nations together. So it doesn't really matter what happens on the surface. That relationship will persist. That may well be the case in Spain. I don't know. But it certainly is the case here in the U.K.
Well, you're right. We do have a very special relationship. And talking about special relationships, come on, let's dive back now and talk about Zero Point. And somehow or another, Zero Point is related to the research on anti-gravity. How?
Well, that's how I came into the story. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, I was investigating 10 or 12 years ago the possibility that we, somewhere in the world, had cracked the anti-gravity code. What that then led me into was a discussion of zero-point energy, because what I discovered was that there was a relationship between gravitational force and the zero-point energy field. At least that is an argument put forward by some very leading researchers. One of them, a guy called Dr. Hal Puthoff, an American based in Texas.
Of course.
A very respected scientist, published many peer-reviewed papers on the relationship between the zero-point energy field and gravitational and inertial force. Now, in essence, what we have in the zero-point energy field is a field of energy that exists on an almost undetectable level. It does exist now. We can detect it. But in essence, when you chill space down to absolute zero, you find that particles, electromagnetic energy, continues to be there, jiggling around, flashing in and out of existence. And the supposition is that if you can tap into that energy, those energy fluctuations, then you have a limitless source of energy. And the density levels of this energy are said to be enormous. In fact, Hal Puthoff said to me, and I know he tells anyone who'll listen, that there is enough energy in the volume of a coffee cup, in theory, to boil the world's oceans many times over. So those are the kind of energy density levels, in theory, that we're dealing with. The problem is, of course, is making technology that can extract that energy from the vacuum.
And understanding why we can only get a faint glimpse of something with so much massive potential.
Absolutely. And we are getting glimpses of that potential already. In my experience, there are people who are now producing small but usable amounts of energy from the vacuum of space.
Give me some examples. What have you seen?
Well, there is an individual who doesn't want to step out of the limelight quite yet, but who is in America and who has developed a device which, to my satisfaction, is producing small but usable amounts of energy from...
Tell me everything you know about the device. I mean, did you get to see it? Did you get a demonstration? Did you get to examine the device? Tell me what you know.
I haven't seen the device yet, but we have talked about it at length. I have sent emissaries to go and look at people I know who are scientists to go and look at the device.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back to me and said, this is real. It is producing usable amounts of energy. And so at the earliest opportunity, I'm going to go out and see this guy. I mean, unfortunately, there is, you know, there have been huge demands on my time since
the
publication of the book, and a lot of people stepped forward making these claims. So I have to be very careful about,
you've got to be careful about the whole thing, Nick. But tell me if you know, if you sent a scientist, what did this scientist come back and tell you about the energy that it used to get started, or did it keep going perpetually, or give me some idea of what we're talking about?
This particular device requires a small energy input to get started.
Okay.
But once it is up and running, it's a solid state device, and once it is up and running, it continues to churn out small levels of energy of the order of several hundred watts.
Oh.
But it is deemed to be scalable. And in time, the inventor predicts that increasing levels of output will be there. So, and what this tells me is that this is a reflection of many other claims out there that there are devices which tap into the zero-point energy field. Now, as I say, I haven't had an opportunity to look into many beyond this one, but...
That's all right. I want to know as much as I can about this one. For example, are there moving parts? Is there a magnetic field in motion involved in it?
No, it's a solid-state device.
I'll be darned.
So it just sits there and interacts with the zero-point field to produce its energy output. Now the guy actually, he has several other inventions which utilize other methods, including rotating magnetic fields for energy extraction. But it's this particular one that he's concentrating on, and I think which seems to offer the most promise.
Well, that's incredible. Even Nick, at the level of several hundred watts, I thought you were going to be talking about milliwatts or less.
No,
hundred watts, that's the real McCoy, Nick. And you've sent somebody of substantial scientific background who really got an opportunity. Did he tell you he had a full opportunity to examine the apparatus?
Absolutely. Was there for several days and looked into it in some depth. And it satisfied, to his understanding, the criteria for a workable device.
That's incredibly exciting. You know, if something like that really exists, all kinds of things are possible. Nick, like this man's, I would think his life might be in danger.
Well, I don't know. You hear these claims. Personally, I don't subscribe to these views. I'm a kind of touchy-feely kind of guy who needs to go out there and see these things for myself. And when I finally get to examine this piece of kit with my own eyes and see that it works for real, then that's the day that I'm really going to believe it. But as I say, it does show promise, and it intrigues me sufficiently getting these responses back from people that I trust, that what we're looking at here is something real. But it also is reflected by, as I say, many other people out there who claim they are getting usable amounts of energy from the vacuum state. And in fact, if you go back in history and in literature, you find that there are people from years back who are claiming that they can extract usable amounts of energy from the vacuum. And one very interesting case is a guy called Hans Kohler in Germany during the Second World War, who developed a solid-state device, a device with no moving parts, that was producing, according to British intelligence documents, a couple of thousand watts, 2 kilowatts of usable energy.
Huh.
Now, that's what historical archival evidence tells us happened more than 50 years ago.
But common sense, though, Nick, says something else to you. If such a device, honest to goodness, Nick, if it existed, It would be powering homes. It would be powering cities. It would have been invested in. It would have been built. It would have been scaled. It would have been done unless somebody got to the inventor and stopped it all.
Well, in the case of the Kola device and in the British in the British intelligence assessment of it, what they say is, here we have a workable device. It's belting out energy. Hmm. The problem is we don't understand where this energy is coming from. And, of course, 60 years ago, they wouldn't have. There was no discussion of the zero-point energy field. The inventor himself, Hans Kola, even he didn't know really where this energy was coming from. He called it space energy, which, of course, in a sense, it is. But when you don't understand where something, where you're getting your result from,
yes,
there is a tendency either to poo-poo it or put it on the shelf. And in the case of the Kola device, I'm sure this thing was shelved until the scientists who wanted to look at it with rigor could underpin its workings with theory. Now, we get that happening. We also, of course, do get interests in perhaps the energy fields who would want to either control this device or to not to let it get out into the public domain for fear of destabilizing the status quo. And I think that also happens to a degree, although I'm not...
And that, by the way, is not an argument without merit. I'm not sure that a device like that could be set loose on the world without destabilizing perhaps the entire world. Certainly our economy would go topsy-turvy along with a lot of other economies. Yours there, industrialized nations everywhere would go upside down for a little while.
Absolutely. And I think this debate could take place on many levels. There is, first of all, it's the impact that it would have on a domestic economy, an economy based on the fossil fuel economy. That is certainly part of the debate. There is also the proliferation debate. Do you want these devices to get out into parts of the world where ultimately and eventually they may have some kind of weapons potential?
Yes.
I mean, we're glimpsing that now, but in future there could be some scalable engineering element to this, which could result in some weapon of formidable power.
Certainly true. Certainly true. But if there was that development possibility and we knew about the technology, we'd be developing the weapon. We might not be proliferating it, but we'd be developing it. Is there any sign anybody's doing anything like that?
Absolutely. In fact, recently it has come to light that both the U.S. Department of Defense, the U.S. and the U.S. Air Force, and other organizations, the Department of Energy, for example, are all showing increasing levels of interest in the zero-point energy field. Now, I can only imagine that the DOD would be getting in on the act if it saw that there was some kind of weapons potential here. There is an emerging view that this is a subject, the whole subject related to the zero-point field, that is worthy of study. Now, we have to control it in a way that we weren't able to do with the nuclear story to stop it proliferating into the weapons field.
Mm.
But that is going to be a very fine balancing act, a very fine juggling act, to make sure that we get energy from it usable in our everyday lives, but stop it proliferating into the weapons field.
All right. You've got something down here that really blows me away, revolving around Second World War, the Nazis, their secret weapons program. Was there something going on back in Nazi Germany with regard to zero point or anything even related to it and weapons they were developing?
Well, bear in mind that when I was getting into this story, looking to see whether from an aerospace point of view, anyone had developed propellantless propulsion and a means of anti-gravitational force.
Yes.
What the data continued to take me back to was the Second World War.
Huh.
And I did find that there was a very tangible connection between German science of the Second World War and zero-point science and anti-gravitational science. And that in itself is a fascinating story.
Well, that's a long way from a V2.
It certainly is. But what it showed me in looking at the data from a different angle was that there was a whole history of the Second World War, a whole history of what the Germans had been doing, which was not reported in the regular mainstream history book.
All right. Well, then, after this break, we're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and find out exactly what the Germans were doing. The Nazis, zero point, anti-gravity, and all of that. Wow. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Can some people really find...
Art Bell. Call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
My guest, Nick Cook, is a heavyweight. He, for 15 years, has been the aviation editor and aerospace consultant of the world-renowned trade publication Jane's Defense Weekly. He knows what he's talking about, and he's a valuable guest to have on the air. We're talking about zero-point energy. In a moment, we'll get right back to it. Don't touch that dial. The Nazis and zero point. There seems to be a story here about what the Nazis were doing in the Second World War. Let's see if we can find out what it is, Nick. All right, the Nazis, what do we know?
Well, of course, it sounds, you know, terribly cliche, doesn't it, that the Nazis may have been involved in this kind of terrible new science. But there, when I was beginning to investigate material for The Hunt for Zero Point, this book, which was published a couple of years ago, I found that there was a traceable element here that resided in what the Germans were doing during the Second World War. Now, you know, I sort of picked up on stories that the Germans had been were reported to have been developing, you know, highly unconventional aircraft during the Second World War, and as a specialist in that field, as a defense journalist,
sure,
I wanted to check them out. Now, what I found was that, you know, I'm sure this guy is quite well known to your listeners, an Austrian by the name of Victor Schauberger was experimenting with German funding during the Second World War into some very, very unconventional propulsion sources that ultimately would have gone into aircraft. Now, this propulsion source that Victor Schauberger was developing with German funding was for what we would now call a zero-point energy device, in that it was meant to extract its energy from the zero-point field. Now, there is no evidence, no clear evidence to show that what Victor Schauerberger was developing actually succeeded in working. But what interested me was this funding line. And I followed the funding line and found that it actually came from the SS, who were, of course, the architects of the Holocaust.
Oh, indeed.
And unfortunately, what we have in this period is a very unpleasant intertwined story between what the SS were doing funding what they would have looked upon as novel science, science that perhaps might have led to some breakthrough technologies that might have helped win them the war. And at the same time, their ghastly involvement in the concentration camps and the Holocaust. And as a result, these stories, the story of their scientific work has become blurred and to a large degree lost by the horrors of their crimes.
Who's Kammler? Is it Kammler?
Yeah, well, Kammler was a very interesting figure and is at the heart of this story. When I followed this funding line, what it actually led to was an SS general called Hans Kammler, who was in charge at the end of the war with all of Germany's secret weapons development. Now, Kammler set up a kind of think tank, which was tasked with the development of generations of weapons beyond the V1 and V2 doodlebug and ballistic missile.
Mm-hmm.
And this think tank, which was ensconced in a part of modern-day the Czech Republic at a place called Pilsen, the Skoda Works at Pilsen,
mm-hmm.
was looking into such things as nuclear engines for aircraft and also beam weapons, so exotic laser-type weapons, and this was 60 years ago. Now, of course, we've already been discussing how the Germans were actually developing a zero-point energy reactor. And Hans Kohler, in Berlin, towards the end of the war, succeeded in developing a device which belted out, even according to British intelligence documents, several kilowatts of energy. So here was a story behind the documented history of the Second World War, which was showing me that the Germans were involved in what we would call as radical science, and that they were throwing real money at it. And as we know, the Germans, who have a very good and developed sense of engineering, in my experience, would not be throwing good money at holy crackpot ideas. And that's what got me into the kind of the whole German angle.
Well, again, Kammler disappeared mysteriously. Now, every time, I don't see how you can ignore the fact, Nick, that every time you have a story like this about energy apparently from ether, the ether, you also, more than half the time, have a story of a mysterious disappearance or documents that flash into thin air or get absorbed by the government or somebody dies. Now, that's it. I mean, over half of them, at least.
Well, I mean, first of all, let me just say that in my experience, and you know, and I am talking to people involved in this field today, you know, I have found no evidence yet of that level of conspiracy. Of course, I'm aware of those stories, but the people that I'm talking to on an everyday level are just getting on with what they see as, you know, real and interesting and new science.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, when you go back to the Kammler story, I mean, I think the Kammler story goes way beyond simply what we're talking about here about kind of zero-point physics. Kammler was charged with all of Germany's secret weapons development at the end of the Second World War. And as we know, even from published accounts of what they were doing in terms of developing, you know, the V1, which was the progenitor of today's cruise missiles, and the V2, which was the progenitor of today's ballistic missiles, you know, those were technologies that Germany's enemies, the Western allies, would have given and indeed did give their ITs for at the end of the Second World War. Now, that man, Kammler, tasked with V1 and V2 development, and we now know, or at least I know through my research, with a whole generation beyond of secret weapons beyond the V1 and the V2, Kamla would have been a man highly sought after by the Allies. Now, there is strong evidence, as documented in my book, The Hunt for Zero Point, that Kamla did do a deal to save himself from the gallows. Bear in mind that the SS were not just tasked with radical follow-on second generation of secret weapons technology, but they were also deeply involved in the machinery of the Holocaust.
Sure.
These were people who would have been hot on the list of any trials prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials.
Sure.
So Kamla, it seems, there's no proof, but it seems, did do a deal. He told Albert Speer, the head of Germany's armaments program at the end of the Second World War, and we have this through Speer's own testimony, that he wanted to do a deal with the Americans, trading top secret technology in return for his life.
Huh.
And lo and behold, at the end of the Second World War, Hans Kamla disappears off the face of the globe in very mysterious circumstances. There are four conflicting accounts of his death, none of which, to my mind, stacks up to any real scrutiny.
Hmm.
And so here we have a guy who knew everything in terms of secret weapons development at the end of the Second World War, who was highly sought after, and who disappeared. Now, kind of draw your own conclusions, but, you know, that, to me, stacks up as a pretty powerful piece of argument for saying that Kamla did his deal, and most probably with America.
Okay, well, I'm still sticking with my, an awful lot of people who get involved in this kind of story seem to come to mysterious ends, and or their work comes to a mysterious end. I mean, it's just, of course, I guess you can understand in his situation why it's a mysterious end, but it happens a lot. So you really, so then we got him? Is that what your best guess would be? We as in the U.S.?
I believe so, yes. Based on what Kamla told Albert Speer, based on the fact, too, that if you go into the U.S. National Archives and ask for information on Hans Kamla, you will get very, very little out. Now, if you ask on information on almost everyone else involved in the upper echelons of the Nazi establishment at the end of the Second World War, you will get reams of data on them. But there is a very suspicious lack of any corroborating evidence on Kamla. So little is known about this guy. And yet he was, outside of Hitler's inner cabinet, the most powerful individual in Nazi Germany at the end of the Second World War. You know, it's always very interesting for me, having done this research now, I will go and look in any new book that appears on Nazi Germany, any new, you know, kind of written by a well-respected author.
Yes.
And you go to the index section, and you flick it through, and you get to the K's, and you look up Kamla, and there is next to nothing, usually, on this individual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because someone, I think, has done a very good job of excising Kamla from the official records.
All right. Nick, we've got the story on Kamla. We've got the story on Nikola Tesla and others. One would not be too far out of line to project that with what you can speculate on and you've dug up and you know, certainly our government at some level knows a hell of a lot more. They've got perhaps even the real McCoy. They may have the end of the rainbow on Zero Point, or at least enough knowledge about it to proceed if they wanted to. And so my question to you is, Nick, if our government did possess this answer, would they, in your opinion, keep it all locked up for as long as they can, so that weapons would not be, there would not be proliferation? We discussed this a little while ago. In other words, would they keep it secret?
Unquestionably, yes.
Uh-huh.
And the answer, and of course there are very clear reasons for doing that, some of which we've discussed already. I mean, the main one is, of course, you don't want your enemies to even begin to have an inkling that you are developing this stuff, because knowing that something is doable is half the battle to developing something.
All right. Where along the line of we're running out of oil eventually, or we're poisoning our atmosphere, we're hurting our environment, somewhere along this road, as the road narrows toward whatever this is leading us toward, the pressure to release such information, to make it public, to change the world, would have to become so large that you would find a way to do it, to avoid a suicidal result for the entire world.
Yeah, and this is the dilemma, of course. But if you are a military man and you have within your bag of tricks technology that is essentially weapons technology, you are not going to want to release that into the world until the very last moment. You probably wouldn't want to release it at all. Of course, what we see when we see developments that are brought to fruition in the black world, that is the classified world of military development, you do get some catching up in the white world. And I think that's really what we're seeing here. In essence, you have technology. We certainly know that the knowledge for zero-point-based technologies has been in existence for quite some time. And using that knowledge and perhaps bringing it to the fore in terms of technology in the black world would have been a very sensible option. But in the meantime, of course, in the white world, you get some catch-up. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing now. We're seeing the white world of open development catching up with what has happened before secretly in the past. And, of course, one can only speculate where those technologies have got to in the world of classified development.
Mm.
But we have some very interesting parallels in terms of things like stealth technology. Stealth was developed in the black world. It was developed in secret and kept secret for at least 10 years before we in the open world, in the white world, knew that it was happening. So secrets can be kept, and they can be kept for quite a long time. And you guys in the States are particularly adept at doing that.
We seem to be, yes. So then the black world must be keeping a really close eye on the white world. And occasionally, hither or yon, or maybe the guy that you've had investigated, or, I mean, somebody pops up, and I'm sure the lid threatens to come off the top.
Yeah, I'm sure every now and again somebody does pop out of the woodwork and say, look, you know, I've developed this device or that device. And maybe there are occasions when he can be bought off or he can be put back in the box in some way.
Yes.
But the problem is now with the Internet is that this information is now widespread. And I think there is a kind of recognition that you can only keep the lid on this particular box for so long because the sheer weight of evidence showing that this is now, you know, there is real and emerging science in this means that the lid just cannot be kept on that box. The Internet and the discussion of this technology that the Internet has allowed means that it's coming out. It's coming out into the open, and there's really very little that people can do to stop that.
How's this affecting you at work? I mean, since you wrote Hunt for Zero Point, I'm sure that you probably have become known as the Zero Point Guy at Jane's to some degree. And, you know, because you follow it, it is kind of an edgy thing. And how's that affected your career?
Well, actually, it's been fine. I mean, insofar as I've always covered technology that is on the cutting edge of known science. That's been something that I've always been very interested in. I covered Soviet developments during the latter stages of the Cold War. I covered the stealth story and other exotic weapons technology stories during the 1990s. And it was kind of really only like a natural progression of that, that I should be looking at some of this new science in terms of zero-point physics that has kind of cropped up on the on the cusp of the new millennium.
But I mean, you are the guy who could do it. You could come to the United States, go and visit the person you told me about, bring some scientific advisors with you, and you could write the story that would rock the world. Are you going to do that?
Well, I'm certainly hoping to do something like that, Art. Yeah, absolutely.
that would just, it would rock the world. There's no other way to put it. It would rock the whole world. That would change, it would change everything.
It would change everything, but bear in mind that, you know, I'm not the first person to write about this stuff. There is plenty of literature out there looking at the zero-point spectrum, the zero-point story.
Maybe but as a story in Jane's by Nick Cook saying, here it is, world, the free energy, it's real, here it is. That kind of story.
Well, you know, it's interesting, but I mean, I was recently sent some material from a symposium that took place in Albuquerque a couple of weeks ago called STIFE, which looks at essentially space propulsion, space physics. And here we had an abstract given a talk given by the U.S. Department of Energy, which talks about usable energy being derived from the zero-point field. So even now, you have the Department of Energy standing up and saying, there is energy, that usable energy, electricity, that can be extracted from the vacuum state. So I feel that I'm not actually that far in advance of the bow wave here. The bow wave is really catching up, and the bow wave, even in the establishment, is saying that zero-point energy is delivering tiny, as yet, but usable amounts of energy. Well, what the inventor community is saying is, we've known about this stuff for a long time. And actually, it's not just tiny amounts of energy.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, if you're talking about hundreds of watts, or say a couple of kilowatts, then on scale, you're talking about powering cities, nations, the world, ultimately. Nick, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Nick Cook from Jane's Defense Weekly is my guest. His book is The Hunt for Zero Point. You might want to look that one up and do a little bit of reading yourself. Once again, it's called The Hunt for Zero Point by Nick Cook. We'll be right back.
To burst up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memories hoard, and they use them to help us to
want to take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
I wonder if people who write about zero point occasionally mysteriously disappear. My guest is Nick Cook. He comes to us from the prestigious Jane's Defense Weekly. It's an impeccable publication that follows defense workings of both on the white side and the black side, probably more on the black side than any other. Probably occasionally gets in trouble for revealing things they ought not. This is Coast to Coast AM, so along with everything else, I think I'll ask Nick Cook in a moment, gives him time to think about it, whether he has any indication at all that anybody has ever back-engineered anything from alien technology. Pretty out there, but hey, that's our program. This is Coast to Coast AM, so we ask these kinds of questions. Nick, there's been a ton of speculation. I've interviewed fascinating people like Colonel Corso and others who have made pretty outrageous claims about alien technology, recovered technology from crashes of alien craft that has been introduced to the white world in a kind of an interesting way, you know, leaked into industry in an interesting way, producing some of the things we now regard as rather common. So I wonder if there's any indication in all the work you've done and all the defense stuff that you've looked at that something might have come from technology other than the mind of a human.
Well, you know, as out there as I am in terms of investigating new science and new technology,
not that far.
I'm probably not that far out, and it's not really a story that I'm aware of what's been written about in the literature, but it's not really anything that I've ever looked into.
Okay.
You know, my own feeling is that there is enough here that we're doing in terms of terrestrial science and technology, which, you know, is fantastic in terms of its potential. There's more than enough material there for me to get my teeth into, so I've really kind of never delved into those other possibilities.
Okay, I just had to ask. Where is Zero Point in your opinion right now? I mean, is Nick going to have to go write the article that I talked about, or is there going to be... Where do you expect the next big revelation or step to come from?
Well, you know, this is an evolving story, and I'm a pretty cautious individual, and I need to be really satisfied that what is happening out there, or appears to be happening out there in the environment, in terms of people extracting, you know, small but usable amounts of energy from the vacuum,
mm-hmm.
Is something that's real, that it's backed by real science, real technology. And I'm not in a hurry to jump to any judgments or conclusions on that. You know, I need to go out there and just rigorously go through it and make sure that this is not some weird sort of anomaly, that, you know, we really are now on the cusp of this new era. And I think that's the exciting thing here, is that we appear to be on the cusp of a new era where we can actually tap into this new physics to get what perhaps by the end of the mid or perhaps the midpoint or the end of the 21st century will be a whole new energy economy. And I certainly feel, you know, as a human being, that this is somewhere we need to be going, because, you know, sure as hell, the way we're burning up fossil fuel at the moment, yes. A, there's not going to be much left by the end of the 21st century, and B, environmentally, it's just doing us no good at all. So, you know, something needs to change, and I feel that the signs that I'm getting back from the community out there is that we now are on the cusp of that change.
I want to run something by you very quickly, Nick, for what it's worth. I'm a ham operator. I put up this monstrous antenna, Nick. It's up on 13 towers, 13 radio towers I've got here. And it's two wires on each tower, and it's a total of about 4,400 feet of wire, Nick. 75 feet up in the air, and then the wire below it is 68 feet. This is a monstrous antenna. Most hams don't do anything of this size. They did it in the old days. But I've measured a voltage on this antenna, Nick, that's always there. It's always there on quiet days when the sun is out and the wind is not blowing and it's calm. There's 300 plus volts there. I have no idea what it is. I've sort of just, it's quite a mystery. I've put something in so that it doesn't harm my equipment. Because I use the antenna, thank you very much, as an antenna and don't care to damage my equipment. My point is, though, that voltage is there, and I'm not sure where the hell it's coming from. I wonder if you've looked into it. It's somewhat Tesla-like in a way. I mean, it's there, and I have no idea why it's there or where it's coming from. I've pretty well eliminated coupling from the AC line, so there's something pretty weird going on there.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are many things, you know, that we currently, people like you reporting similar kinds of anomalies.
Yes.
That once you run all the checks, you know, all the checks that one would expect to do in a rigorous kind of way to find out what's going on, you still get that anomaly. And, you know, I think in time these anomalies are going to be explained by science and physics. Quite often at the moment they're not, but this, you know, what we're moving into is an era in which things that we called strange phenomena in the past, things that kind of our forebears perhaps thought happened by magic, will actually have a scientific explanation. And that's what I'm looking really to do at all times. I'm looking to try and explain things in the past that people have called phenomena by science. And I know that, you know, you've investigated on your program and talked about the John Hutchison series of experiments.
Absolutely.
At length and in depth. Hutchison is interesting because in another age, perhaps we would have described him as a magician. Now I think that the phenomena that he'd been producing in his laboratory, which ranged from the transmutation of metals through to levitation, and other forms of kind of paranormal type phenomena are now beginning to be explained by the science of the zero point field. And that is as I think it should be. I don't think we should write off strange happenings as, inexplicable paranormal phenomena.
Certainly,
they
could be the key. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, Nick. We've got this transatlantic thing. But there's the Coral Castle, for example, in Florida. That's just a total enigma. I mean, this man moved rocks and did things that without the aid of something that lessened or canceled gravity would have been impossible.
I'm not that familiar with the Coral Castle story. I'm aware of it. And a number of people have pointed it out to me as, you know, an extraordinary place where, you know, apparently extraordinary things have been happening. But, you know, for me, it's really important that I don't jump to conclusions. I need to quantify anything strange, and if it can't be quantified, then I have to leave it on one side. In the hunt for zero point, everything that's down there is real world experimentation, and where it's not, I'm very careful to say it's speculation. I think it behoves us to be rigorous about what we see, and when I go out there and I investigate these stories, I have to be equally rigorous.
Well, an interesting thing happened when I was researching material for the antenna that I built, Nick. What I found out was that a lot of technology regarding very, very large antenna arrays was pretty common a long time ago. And I'm talking about when radio first began, when they were doing back in the spark gap days. They were putting up antenna arrays that produce some incredible results, much of which has been either lost, forgotten, or put up on the shelf. But it's no less valid today than it was then. It's just sort of a lost part of science. Someone put it up on the shelf, and that's that.
Absolutely. And we find this reflected currently in the whole zero-point energy debate. You know,
yes.
In the latter part of the 19th century, there were a whole range of physicists who were stepping up and talking about ether physics.
Yes.
Well, actually, it's just mutated into a different name. We now talk about zero-point physics.
Yes.
But essentially, the underlying source of the debate is the same. So it just appears that we kind of go through different fads and we go through different eras in which these subjects get lost.
And you believe that when we're not able to explain the reason for something happening, that in itself becomes enough justification to put it up on the shelf and just sort of say, okay, well, that's in my gray box. Maybe I'll come back to it, but it's up on the shelf for now.
Absolutely. And I think that when science cannot explain something with a theory, it is very loath to go out there and kind of institutionalize it.
Yes.
By underpinning it with, legitimate debate. So when it doesn't understand it, when it can't quantify it with theory, as you say, it puts it on the shelf and goes, not consciously, but it kind of subconsciously puts it on the shelf and think, and then people leave it there until they can revisit it with physics they can more readily explain. And I think that now we're moving into this greater understanding of the fact that there is zero-point energy, what in the past physicists called the ether, and that we are now beginning to measure the electromagnetic energy within this zero-point energy field. We're beginning to understand that possibly the zero-point energy field may be the underlying reason for forces we don't readily understand, like gravity. We know what gravity does, but we don't know how we don't know what causes it. And we're beginning to go into this new and exciting era.
All right. I've got something I want to ask about that. When our American shuttle program, Nick, did something that was really fascinating. They had this a tether experiment. I know you know what I'm talking about. And the tether produced so much energy that it snapped the tether right at the shuttle and almost produced a disaster. So much energy was flowing through this tether, which glowed in space like this giant glowing noodle or something. It was amazing, and I haven't heard another thing about it.
Well, the trouble is we all have kind of areas of specialty, and in Jane's, that's equally so. And my area of specialty has actually been more on the kind of the Earth, or rather the endo-atmospheric end of aerospace. So I don't tend to cover space subjects. I tend to cover aircraft more than space. I'm familiar with the experiment. I'm aware that the tether broke, and I'm aware of all the things that that energy state that seemed to exist on the tether.
There may be a relationship.
But I haven't heard any more. It's not a story I ever investigated.
No, but there may be somewhere there a relationship. I don't know what it would be, but I just know that the tether experiment was a gigantic surprise to scientists, and there hasn't been a follow-up that I'm aware of. Key phrase, that I'm aware of. I'm sure they're looking into it, but maybe there's some sort of relationship between the power exhibited there and zero point somewhere. I don't know.
Well, the one thing that that we do know now is that, government bodies like the Department of Energy are wanting to put experiments into space to quantify and measure the zero-point field.
Yes.
Those types of experiments are now actively being looked at in the open. So it all seems to be kind of bubbling away in just the same way as nuclear physics was bubbling away just before the Second World War, and as we know, towards the end of the Second World War in 1945, the experimenters produced a workable weapon. Now, only 6 years earlier, half the physics community was saying that building such a weapon, extracting energy from the atom, was not possible. And yet 6 years later, they did it.
Wow.
And I think that's kind of where we stand in the zero-point community. There are people who say that it's doable, that you can extract energy from the vacuum, and there are people who say it's rubbish physics. It'll never happen.
All right. Well, theoretical physicists now, Nick, are talking about something called dark energy, that the universe is flooded with this dark energy. And I wonder if dark energy might not be behind or a synonym for zero point.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, I'm reading now from that Department of Energy paper where it says a vacuum energy experiment is discussed based on the dark energy research funded by the U.S. Department of Energy.
Uh-huh.
And that same paper goes on to discuss how it may be possible to extract energy from the zero-point field. So there is a clear correlation, at least in the minds of some physicists, that there is a relationship between dark energy and zero-point energy.
I wonder, do you think, Nick, that the human race will be able to get to and unveil zero-point energy before it blows itself to smithereens? That's actually kind of an interesting question.
When you say blow itself to smithereens, in terms, in real terms, do you mean? In physical terms, in the development of weapons?
Well, before the environment collapses, or before we have a nuclear war, or before we get to fighting over oil on a scale that would, you know, threaten human life, or I don't know, Nick, whatever it is that's laying out there for us, will we unveil all this somewhere prior to that bad ending?
Well, of course, that is a moot and worrying point. But I think that what is required will be for a kind of consciousness shift, if you like, where we recognizing that there are emerging signs in the technology world that that technology may be developed that taps into the zero point field, and when you get that, the meeting of that kind of new technology and the new possibilities inherent in that technology with a market need. I mean, that's what's required. It will be a perception by us that what we currently have is just doing us immense amounts of damage, and B is just kind of outmoded. When you think about the fact that we're still burning fossil fuels, you know, several hundred years after we started to burn them for energy purposes, it just seems so archaic. And I think ultimately, there will be a market pull, a recognition by us that something's got to change. And then they'll look into the inventor community and see what might be available to bring about that change. Now, I just hope that what we're beginning to see in the inventor community, albeit I'm being very cautious here, but it may provide the answer. Still, an awful lot of engineering and an awful lot of validation has to be done to prove that there really is extractable energy from the zero-point field, but it does seem to offer hope.
There have been a number of, trade-type shows where people have been invited to bring their various devices and show them. I think there was one in Colorado somewhere recently, and inevitably you never get to see the inside of these devices. They're always proprietary, as you would expect something. I mean, if somebody really came up with something, they're going to demonstrate it, and they're not going to want to give the whole thing away. But it makes people naturally suspicious. Have you gone to any of these shows or had people go to them and look at these devices?
No, I haven't personally. I mean, I'm aware of that debate. And, of course, you know, you can understand their reservations, as you say, about exposing the innards of something that they think may change the world,
of course,
to scrutiny on that level. But, of course, at the same time, we have to recognize that that level of scrutiny has to be given to a machine that is that fantastic.
Uh-huh.
So it's a never-ending tussle. But, you know, it's one that's going to be going on perpetually, I think, you know, until this technology does emerge out there in a kind of more widespread way.
That's right. All right, hold on, Nick. We're at the top of the hour. When we get back, we'll begin to go to calls. So if you have questions for Nick Cook, who's at the leading edge of investigating zero-point energy for a very fine publication, Jane's Defense Weekly, and the book he wrote, Hunt for Zero Point, which you might check into, well, then get on the telephone because we're going to the phones with Nick Cook in Great Britain coming up next.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm.
Can some people really...
Bye.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It certainly is free on the, it's been free, and this whole weekend free on Streamlink, by the way. And now you can download these programs and save them to a CD and an MP3. They've arranged for it. That's pretty cool stuff, in my opinion. So is this show. Nick Cook, Jane's Defense Weekly, is my guest. And listen, coming up, you're going to get an opportunity to talk to Nick Cook. Now, bear a couple things in mind for me here, and bear with me during this. Nick Cook is in Great Britain. So that's an expensive phone call, I guess, huh? Anyway, we've got a satellite connection to Great Britain, and there's a little bit of a delay. And so when you call, it's best if you formulate your question and then ask it and then just stop and pause and let Nick Cook answer, because there is a satellite delay and it makes interaction sometimes a little uncomfortable and direct interaction even difficult because you tend to keep interrupting each other because of that delay. So if you could kind of get your question oriented so that you can ask it and then sort of turn it over to Nick, everything will run a little bit smoother. But all of you, up and coming. And incidentally, though we've been talking about zero-point energy, since we've got somebody from Jane's Defense Weekly, I would see no harm in asking about advanced weapons systems and advanced aircraft and all that sort of stuff, if you really want to. Shouldn't be a problem there. We'll be right back and get to it. All right. Once again, I do appreciate those who call with a question for me, but relevant right now is Nick Cook, who is my guest. So if you call, you should have a question for Nick Cook. And again, if you would be so kind out there as to sort of formulate your question so you can ask it, taking the transatlantic weight problem away from us, I would very much appreciate that. Nick, we're about to go to the phones. Your book, The Hunt for Zero Point, I take it still available, generally, Amazon, those sorts of places, right?
Oh, yeah. It was only published in softcover in September last year. So it's still out there. It's in the shops, and it's also on Amazon. So, yeah, it's very much out there.
Are you going to write another one?
Well, a lot of people have asked me this, and actually, originally, I kind of said no. You know, I've had enough. Well, not had enough. It seemed to have kind of, the journey had seemed to kind of reached its logical conclusion. But actually, the feedback I've had from the book has been overwhelming, and it's led me into a lot of new and interesting areas, and I suspect that there will be a second volume before too long.
Okay, well, that's definitely progress. Here we go. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Nick Cook in Great Britain. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I'm calling from West Los Angeles, California.
Yes, sir.
On KFI. Mr. Cook expressed a comment early in the show on the ASAT, the Satellite Killer Program, and that's been denied by our defense establishment for quite a while.
Of course.
I've got a picture here that I kept as a souvenir when I left Hughes Aircraft, and it's a F-15 at about a 45-degree angle above about 90% of the atmosphere. The tail number is AF74084, and it has an ASAT mounted on the right inboard pylon. And it's a big piece of hardware. The sucker was about 35 feet long and about a foot and a half in diameter. So if anybody wishes to deny it, hey, I've got a picture of it. It hung on the wall in my laboratory for a long time.
Well, the technical question was whether we had weapons in space. That's what I asked Nick. You're saying we've got weapons that can go there plenty quick and kill satellites, right?
Yes, sir. This aircraft was almost exo-atmospheric at the time the picture was taken.
You know about that, Nick?
Yeah, very much so. In fact, that was the weapon that I was talking about when I was talking about an endo-atmospherically launched ASAT. And we did, as our caller said, that experiment was done some time ago. It was launched by an F-15. The aircraft climbed to a high altitude and launched the weapon from its belly at a steep angle, and the missile climbed into space and would intercept a satellite and kill it. And that experiment was carried out. We know about that. But as you said, Art, there are two elements to this debate. There is the capability that exists to do that, and we know that that can be done using that kind of missile and aircraft technology. But it's what's happened beyond that is the question. You know, do we have out there a deployable capability to kill satellites from other space-based platforms? And, you know, that is a moot point, and that aspect is the one that's been denied.
Well, you know, you've got to wonder, Nick, and it's worth speculating about, if the world's satellites suddenly generally ceased to exist, or there was a war that began by each country taking out the other satellites, which most certainly I guess it would, I wonder if our nation is prepared to continue without satellites. It's an interesting question to ask. If the satellites that we have today were gone, first of all, as of this moment, you and I would not be talking.
Correct.
Beyond that, the world's finances are sent electronically through satellites. Billions of dollars flies across the earth while you sleep at night by satellite. Things happen by satellite that we now take for granted, and how much of our economy would collapse without them?
Well, this gets to the heart of a kind of rather chilling new kind of war form known as information warfare. And the U.S., certainly the U.S. Air Force, recognizes that to dominate today's and tomorrow's battle spaces, we have to dominate the information spectrum. Mm-hmm. It's all very well being able to move on the battlefield and to dominate in terms of air superiority over the battlefield, but you've got to know what the enemy is doing. And to do that, you have to kind of get inside what's known as his decision loop. And that means, of course, having access to loads of information. And much of that information, as you rightly say, not just in a military sense, but in a commercial sense, is derived from satellites. And so it would be very natural for an enemy to target those satellites and to target carriers of information to disrupt the flow of information and to try and paralyze us on the battlefield. And, you know, we know that we, the good guys, are implementing and investing loads of programs to invest in that technology. We can only presume that the bad guys are doing it as well. And of course, then measures have to be put in place to stop the disruption of the information.
Well, one satellite had trouble a few years ago. It was really interesting. And oh, wow, Nick, ATM machines stopped working. Grocery stores came to a halt. All sorts of weird things happened across doctors, pagers weren't going off. I mean, it was just sort of a little taste and a little touch of what could happen if the massive array of satellites that we've got suddenly was, for some reason, disabled. Is our economy, are we getting too dependent on something that's that potentially fragile?
Well, I think there's no question that our level of investments in kind of internet-based technologies, in communications that rely on, you know, solid-state means of transmission, all of these are prone to electronic attack. And if, you know, if again we kind of extrapolate from what is being invested in by our side in those types of technologies, and we get a kind of glimpse of that through conflicts like last year's Iraq conflict, it was interesting there was a lot of debate about, you may remember, about shock and awe in the days preceding the initial assault on Iraq.
You bet.
Now, shock and awe, which we kind of tended to think of as this kind of massive kind of bombardment, which was meant to stun Iraq into submission, was in fact a much more subtle document than that. It went into many, many different ways of paralyzing an enemy. And one of those ways is to disrupt his information flow. And that can then reach into all aspects of society. If you knock out a power station, of course, you know, you can effectively paralyze parts of a country.
Oh, yes.
You can do that with weapons that leave hardly any trace in the environment that you've done it. And I'm thinking of things like microwave weapons, which send a pulse of energy into electronic circuitry and destroy that circuitry.
How much evidence is there, Nick, that we use those kinds of weapons in the Baghdad area, for example?
Well, there's no evidence that we used microwave weaponry this time around. In the 1991 Gulf conflict, we used a then-secret weapon which dropped carbon filaments onto power stations, which then shorted out the power stations.
Right.
Now, we are pretty confident. In fact, I'm 99.9% confident that we have and have deployed, ready for use, microwave weapons which are able to do that same thing by sending a pulse of microwave energy at, say, a power station, or perhaps at a radar command, or a command post, or a radar station. So those technologies are now at a deployable state. They, to our knowledge, though, they weren't used in Iraq, but daily things come out about what was used in Iraq in a classified sense, and who knows, maybe in a year or two, someone might admit to have using one of those weapons experimentally.
I'll tell you a pretty interesting story. Quick one, Nick. I live here in Pahrump, Nevada. Fascinating place, adjacent to the, you know, infamous or famous Area 51.
Yep, know it well.
I've seen something happen in my valley, Nick, that would seem to verify a little bit of what you're talking about. I live pretty high tech for being out in the sticks. I mean, I've got a KU band satellite uplink here. I've got internet delivered to me by terrestrial microwave, which is very efficient. On this one night, Nick, I lost my microwave transmitter, and it went down. I mean, I literally could go in the other room, and I could see the return power as it was. It's like an electromagnetic blanket dropped over this valley. And anything emitting electromagnetic anything was just sort of soaked up. And to prove it, the internet company that provides service to me monitors, I don't know, 20 or more different radios on towers around the valley here. And at the very time I lost my microwave, every single one of their radios, and they had it graphed, went down to zero. In other words, from point to point here in the valley, the ability to reach that point to point, which is normally 100%, went to absolute zero, and it descended on this valley and lasted about 40 minutes or so, Nick, and then it was lifted. It was like it just, like blanket was lifted up and everything started working again. What do you think that might have been?
Well, you know, when it comes to new weapons being tested, of course, you are probably in the, you know, the one place in the world you don't want to be.
Yeah, that's right.
And I mean, I know from having gone out to, camp out and soak up the atmosphere around Area 51 and Groom Lake and all the rest of it, that it's a pretty interesting place, and you can see some pretty interesting things from time to time. I mean, I've certainly seen an object over Groom Lake, which sort of defied explanation.
Yes.
But that doesn't necessarily kind of, you know, have me reaching for my kind of UFO recognition books, because we always try and explain these things conventionally.
We try.
But you certainly, you know, if they're going to deploy a weapon and test it, yeah, then chances are it's going to be tested over the Nellis Ranges somewhere, and of course that puts you in the vicinity of that testing. So
yes,
nothing would surprise me in your neck of the woods, is what I'm saying.
Well, that really happened, which would indicate to me that we have the ability to virtually do something electromagnetically that makes horse meat out of any kind of microwave signal. I mean, just take everything to zero. I saw it happen with my own eyes. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Hi.
All right.
Yes.
How you doing, Art?
Just fine.
First of all, say hello to Yeti for me and give George a raise for that great interview with Alex Jones, even if you don't agree with the guy.
Okay.
I want to back this guy up 100% in his research. First of all, let me, for all your listeners, so they can check out what I'm about to say if they want to look at one source, Technology Review, MIT's Magazine of Innovation, the August 2001 issue. There is an article in there called The Light Brigade by David Friedman. And let me tell you a little bit about what's going on here. First of all, Freeman Dyson, the world's premier physicist at the Advanced Institute, in his recent book, The Sun, the Genome, and the Internet, poo-pooed the idea and predictions by sci-fi writers that laser weapons were an inevitable part of the future, which I found shocking. Not only are they already, you know, not only are they an inevitable part of the future, they're already here and they exist and they've been tested. They've been tested at Kirkland Air Force Base in New Mexico, White Sands Missile Range, the U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command in Huntsville, Alabama, and they're being developed by companies such as Boeing and TRW.
Can you confirm any of that, Nick?
Wait, there's more, Art.
Well, all right, just hold on. Can you confirm any of that?
Well, we know absolutely what the caller is saying in terms of the fact that Kirtland and U.S. Army Missile Command at Huntsville, Alabama, Kirtland Air Force Base out in New Mexico are involved, deeply involved with high energy research. TRW and Boeing, well, those are companies that would have great interest in pursuing those kinds of technologies. There's no confirmation officially that those companies are involved in those fields, but of course they're involved in a lot of secret research.
Okay, so, caller, that sounds like a yes. Proceed.
Okay, so here's what the military remains queasy about calling attention to the interest of battlefield lasers. This is from the article. The programs aren't secret. That tactic already backfired once for the government with the optics hunting laser projects, but the policy appears to be one of not volunteering information unless pressed. And even when pressed, most military and civilian managers involved in laser defense programs deny knowledge of initiatives intended to bring lasers to bear against ground targets. They have a laser that can place a 10-centimeter-wide beam with the heating power of blowtorch against distant targets for 100 shots at several meters away. And like I said, all the pictures you want and information is in this article in Technology Review. It's all public knowledge.
Okay. Nick, any comment on all of that? How far along?
I concur. I can't verify the details of the laser weapon itself, but speaking from my own experience, of course, directed energy weaponry and lasers in particular are currently kind of the vogue weapon of study amongst my peers. When I was looking into laser weaponry a year or so ago, you know, I was told by the defense community that, you know, you better hurry up if you want to investigate and do a story on laser weaponry. Such progress has been made in that field that shortly the doors will be coming down, and getting information out on those programs will become very difficult.
We have
one or two white world programs out there which are, you know, looking at developing lasers. I'm thinking particularly of the laser that's going to be mounted on a Boeing 747, which will shoot down Scuds in the boost phase out to about 400 kilometers. But behind that, those official programs, there are probably programs that are being developed in secret which are yielding extraordinary results. And we do know, for example, that in about 10 years' time, aircraft will be fitted, will get to a point where they can be fitted with battlefield lasers, which will be able to do, in theory at least, exactly what the caller said.
Well, you know, Nick, this is, again, way out there on the coast-to-coast AM-type style question, but there have been these weird things that nobody's ever been able to explain called crop circles. I mean, truly, these are enigmas. And here's a theory for you, Nick. If you had a laser or microwave weapon and it was space-based, or even if it was based in a high-altitude airplane, you know what? You'd have to test it. And they found that these wheat fields with these weird designs, ones that weren't done by a couple guys with boards and chains, were done with what appeared to be microwave energy, Nick. And you just got to wonder, if somebody up there might not be practicing. I'll let you think about that. We've got a break here at the half hour. I'm Art Bell.
A very old friend came by the day because he was telling everyone in town all the love that he just found and the reasoning of his latest plan. He talked and talked and I heard him say that she had the longest, blackest hair, the prettiest green eyes anywhere, and the reasoning of his latest plan. Though I smiled with tears inside of her burning, but I wished him luck again, but he said goodbye. But he was... It used to be so nice, it used to be so good.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
That, of course, is ABBA's SOS. When you think about it, the world right now is crying SOS. Save our souls. We're running out of fuel. And that which we have left, if burned, may do us in anyway. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the military. You have secrets. You have laser weapons. You have possibly zero-point energy. You have the key to the SOS that's being screamed about over here. Two really important things. The future of the world and military secrets. Let's think about that, shall we? By the way, I always try and fit this in somewhere on the weekend. If you want to reach me for any reason, and there could be many reasons you would want to reach me, I understand that. I am reachable. You can find me through email, which is rather instant and effective. Here's my email address. Is artbell@mindspring.com. That's A-R-T-B-E-L-L, lowercase, at mindspring.com. Or artbell@AOL.com. Either one of those avenues will get the message through. My guest is Nick Cook, Jane's Defense Weekly, and here's Nick once again, his book, The Hunt for Zero Point. If you've been intrigued tonight, it's obviously something you ought to pick up, and tonight we learn there may be another on the way. Has there really, Nick, been enough material that has come to light to you in your investigation since you wrote the last book to fill up a new book? If so, that's a lot.
Oh, yeah. There's been reams of new material. And, you know, this surprised me. I thought, as I said, that when I reached the end of the Hunt for Zero Point, the book, that, you know, that kind of would be where I'd leave things. But no, there's been absolute... I can't sort of go into too much detail because I'm going to spoil things for myself if I kind of divulge the entire plot.
Yes.
But there's been no shortage of material, Art. That's absolutely true.
Okay. Back to the phones. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook.
Uh, I've got one for you that is from January 6, 1981 in the Chicago Tribune. A gentleman by the name of Morris Wayman presented a paper to the American Association for the Advancement of Science in which he says he found four microbes and one yeast that would make oil. The gist of the story is that he says he can make 12 million barrels of oil on a square mile of water surface a year.
Huh.
I talked to him a year or two later, and he told me they had cut off his research money.
They? Well, I guess I don't want you to identify the companies or whatever that cut it off.
It was the University of Toronto where he was located.
Okay.
He has a son named Michael Lash Wayman, a chemistry or chemical engineering professor, I think, in Alberta, who told me he knew nothing about what his father had done.
Nick, are you at all familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with this story, although, it sort of jibes with other similar stories of kind of suppression that are out there.
There are a lot of stories of suppression, and so you really have to wonder, you really do have to wonder, darn it, disappearances, people paid off, all the rest of it, you've got to wonder. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook, hi.
Yeah, hi, fellas. I'm calling from Phoenix, listening to KFYI 550 AM.
All right, welcome.
I was watching a documentary about the Joint Strike Fighter development program, specifically between Lockheed and Boeing. And one of the things I noticed when seeing the Boeing aircraft, which actually didn't make it, Lockheed was chosen, as it was hovering about 100 feet over the airstrip, it's a very unconventional looking aircraft. It's rather conventional technology. But hovering there, it looked like something someone might presume came from another planet. Taking that to a greater extreme, I'm sure that there's plenty of a lot of the UFOs seen flying around over the country and elsewhere are probably just unconventional experimental aircraft being developed by black budget programs, which we've spent trillions of dollars on.
Almost surely you are correct about that.
And and I wouldn't even be surprised, some of the flying saucers are using anti-gravity developed by the military. And I wouldn't even be surprised that they actually have operating squadrons set waiting for the next major war to pull out some very nasty surprises against the bad guys.
That could all be true, and I'm sure, Nick, that we do have a bag of surprises that have not been fully open. For example, for the Iraq War that we just had, I personally have had a triangle pass over my head and that of my wife silently about 150 feet above us, headed toward this area known as Area 51, and it appeared to be defying gravity. Certainly not flying, wasn't going fast enough to support itself in the air, so it was either floating or it was defying gravity. What do you know, Nick, about triangular-shaped craft that seem to not make noise? You hear anything about that?
Yeah, a great deal. There was an interesting report issued by the Belgian government a few years ago about a wave of sightings over Belgium in the 1989 and 1990 timeframes, which at the heart of which were these triangular planform craft, which were doing exactly as you say, Art, exhibiting characteristics not dissimilar at all from the craft that you saw. And yet we have no explanation for these, at least not by known terrestrial science. I mean, what I find very interesting is a lot of UFO sightings do tend to reflect technology that we later learn was investigated by the real world. I'm thinking of the stealth program during the 1980s.
Absolutely.
When people in your vicinity down there in Nevada, close to Area 51, were seeing kind of strange lights, strange shapes in the night sky.
You bet.
And later on, we find out that, of course, an extensive stealth program was probably responsible for at least some of those sightings. But it is a minefield. I cannot square your sighting, for example, with anything that I know about in the real world. But that's not to say that something may have been developed.
All right, well,
that was the heart of the journey, really, that I was undertaking when I went to try and find anti-gravity technology to hunt for 0 points.
All right, Nick, here's another one for you. You know what's been happening around here lately in the West Coast?
No.
Maybe you'd like to comment on it. People hear a jet over them, a jet noise or some kind of noise, sounds like a jet, and they look up, and there's nothing there. Nick, there are a lot of people who believe that we have developed essential aircraft invisibility and that we are testing it.
Well, although I cannot, you know, searching in my kind of experience of things that people have told me about in the military and outside the military, but about what's happening inside the classified environment, I cannot find a ready explanation for what people are hearing and not seeing there. But it is known, and I have interviewed a number of people on the edges of the black world in the military who readily admit that the latest thrust of their experimentation and development in stealth terms is to having mastered the electromagnetic spectrum to a large degree. In other words, getting aircraft to be invisible on radar screens.
Yes.
And having mastered to a degree the heat spectrum, getting aircraft to be invisible on infrared screens. And thermal screens. What you want to be doing next is making an aircraft invisible in the visible spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, making them almost impossible to see to the human eye. And we do know that certain experiments have been going on in that direction, using electrochromatic panels, for example, on an aircraft that can mimic the background of the plane. So if you look up at the sky, you would see you would not see the aircraft, hopefully, but because it would be covered with these photochromatic panels.
Which would be mimicking
the background sky.
Exactly. So you essentially would see nothing. That would be the final key to real invisibility. Gee, you've got radar invisibility. They've learned all about that. So why not make it fully invisible? Then you have a craft attacking you that you can only hear. And I've heard they're working on that part of it, too.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, when you listen to an aircraft like the B-2 as it flies over you in throttle back mode, it is extremely quiet. So, and that is now 25-year-old technology. So, you know, it when you think that probably what's going on in the black world, and we have people like the late Ben Rich, who headed up the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, saying that probably what you're going to see in 30 to 40 years time is what is being worked on now in the black world. That kind of gives you an indication of the kinds of levels of technology and expertise that are currently being worked on.
What would you give for a free ticket into Area 51 for, say, I don't know, 12 hours of anything you want to look at?
Well, quite a lot, is the answer. I have made, you know, rather inane applications to do this from time to time, and I get a kind of fairly wry response back. But now I would, you know, words like eye teeth and give my come to mind.
Do you get something back like, we appreciate your interest in our facility?
Yeah, you know, kind of stop response. Yeah,
but bug off.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Hello.
Hi. My name's Steve, and I'm in Phoenix.
Hey, Steve.
I fail to see the mystery of why everybody thinks this energy source that you're talking about is, you know, where it's coming from.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that it seems logical to me anyway that with when you pass a magnetic field over wire or metal, you generate an electrical current.
That's true.
Well, you're talking about a naturally occurring generator here that's in the billions of tons called Earth. It seems to me like you put up a big enough piece of metal, like your antenna,
and
you're bound to generate voltage.
You begin to see effects of it. No, it's logical to me, too, and a number of people have talked about my antenna to me and used the phrase Earth transformer. After all, we do have this magnetic field. We are in rotation, and so actually that what he just said does make sense, doesn't it, Nick?
Well, it does. You know, I wish I were more an expert in that field, but to my mind, it's no great mystery. There we have it.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Nick Cook. Hi.
Hi, this is Dave. I'm listening to KLIF Dallas.
Hi, Dave.
How you doing, Art? Great listening to you. Nick, Mr. Cook. Okay, there was an explosion in Alaska recently that seemed to level out quite a large area, and it was taken from the center of the area and spread its way out, chopping the trees in half and burning the area.
I was thinking that could possibly
be a weapon from space.
Well, of course, you know, we hear about occurrences like this, and I'm very slow to kind of rush to judgment because many fantastic claims are made about exotic weaponry. And, you know, what I really hope, I don't know where this apparent explosion took place, but, you know, if it was on public land, you've got to start worrying about this. And I'm very slow to rush to judgment on these types of stories because they, a lot of myths and kind of legends spring up about them. So, you know, I guess I'd have to know more about this to be able to comment on it. But
I'll tell you about a claim that was made recently that I bet you even heard about. The Russians, they make a lot of claims, but they claimed that they could create a cyclone to put out fires that were raging in Southeast Asia, and they offered, and they said they could do it from space, and they offered actually to create a cyclone, and it was declined for whatever reason. But the Russians made the official offer to create a cyclone as a demonstration of what they could do.
Well, we do know, I mean, that the Russians, and particularly during the Soviet era, were not slow at all in developing deploying weird science for military purposes. I can't comment directly on that one, although I have heard about officially backed experimentations by the Russians into the control of weather. But there was one, for example, I'm sure is well known to your listeners, where Russian experiments in psychic spying led to a mirror image program in the States, funded by the Department of the Army, amongst others, using psychic spies to spy in space and time, surveilling places that satellites could not reach. I'm thinking of underground facilities, you know, where these places were mapped out by people effectively using clairvoyance. Now, the Russians started that program, so, you know, we should perhaps sit up and pay attention to some of the things on the edges of known science that they are apparently doing.
Perhaps, and we should also note, because of that, that, gee whiz, if they'll spend taxpayer money on trained psychics, remote viewers they're called, and for 10 years at that, imagine what else they might be putting money in.
Well, that's kind of my motto, Art, which is that, you know, here's what we know about. So just speculate a little, and particularly, you know, in my privileged position where I'm able to go and see many interesting companies, many interesting technologies, and talk to many interesting people, knowing that, you know, what I'm seeing is probably just the tip of the iceberg. Just imagine what's below the waterline, and sometimes that's what keeps me going. It's sort of, if you're interested in technology, it's a wonderful job.
How frequently, when you're in, a company or an installation or something, and they're demonstrating something to you, do you get the feeling that the guy demonstrating it is sort of saying between the lines, man, I wish I could show you what we're doing right now, but I can't?
Oh yes, a lot. And actually, if you read between the lines of The Hunt for Zero Point, my book, I mean, that's one of the things that keeps me going in the hunt, is this feeling all the time of these incredibly interesting places that I'm going to, people I'm talking to, that behind the scenes there is technology being worked on that these guys can't talk about, but they so want to. They are, after all, engineers and scientists. They want to share this knowledge. But, of course, they're signed up to some pretty austere secrecy oaths, and so they don't. But
do you ever try to get these guys into a pub somewhere and get them greased up a little bit and just pick them?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not averse to standard journalistic techniques here. And I'm not averse to going into a smoky pub myself from time to time. But, It's, yeah, basically, yeah, I mean, I will share a beer over with anyone who, you know, wants to talk about these things. But it's all part of the job, you know.
All right.
It's
so
a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
People should get your book now, The Hunt for Zero Point, and in that way you can get ready for the second book, which we now know is sort of on the way, and on the way, about to be born here. I guess the conception is being considered. And anyway, Nick, what a great pleasure. And it'll always make you a grand guest for this program because you're right out there looking and listening to and studying the edge. I really appreciate you being here tonight.
Thanks for having me on the show, Art.
Oh, okay, you come back.
Will do. Love to.
Take care, Nick.
You too.
Cheers, indeed. That's Nick all the way in London, Nick Cook. And what a guy. Imagine that. How'd you like to be a reporter in his position, you know, ushered into some of the really cool rooms at Boeing, but always seeing that next locked door and wondering yourself, I wonder what's behind that one. Well, what we're up to. Listen, it's been a wonderful weekend. I'll see you back next weekend with whatever it is we come up with. In the meantime, here's Crystal Gale, the right words always to take us out of here. From the high desert, good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight